Good morning. I'm calling the meeting of the House Special Energy Committee to order. Today is Thursday, April 4th, 2024, and the time is 10:15 a.m. Today we're joined by Representative Shragi, Representative McKay, Representative Baker, myself, Chair Rauscher, and I don't see any other legislators in the room. I would like to thank our House Record Secretary, Cale Brown, our LIO moderator, Zach Lawhorn, and my committee aide, Craig Valdez, for all they do for this committee. Before we begin, I ask you all to silence your cell phones, your electronics, and any questions go through the chair and answers likewise. So today's agenda, we're going to hear testimony from Dr. Paul Denholm. Have I pronounced that correctly? By Dr. Paul Denholm, Senior Research Fellow, National Renewable Energy Lab, otherwise known as NREL. He will be presenting his research and the NREL report titled Achieving an 80% Renewable Portfolio Standard in Alaska's Rail Belt with Cost Analysis. During the presentation and testimony, I encourage any committee members to ask questions at the end of each slide that may arise, and I know there will be some. Dr. Denholm, could you come forward? Please put your name on record, your affiliation, and then you can begin your testimony.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Paul Denholm, and I work at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado.
Does any of the committee have any questions before he begins? I would like to say that there's the title talks about a renewable portfolio standard, which we do not have moving right now in the House, but this still incorporates a lot of the information that was done on building a CES, on the portfolio standard that is still in sits in committee. So there is some pertinent information. Please, as you will.
Thank you to the chair and all the committee members. So thank you for the opportunity to talk today about the role of potentially reducing costs for electricity in the rail belt system. So while the title is about 80% renewable portfolio standard and has some context around that, a big part of this is just the general state of the technology and the general opportunities for renewable energy to reduce costs for rail belt electricity consumers.
Okay, interrupt for a second.
Please.
Appreciate it. We're joined right now by Representative Wright. Thank you.
So I work at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. We are part of the National Lab System founded on the Atomic Nuclear Weapons Program at Los Alamos, that kind of stuff. So we support the U.S. Department of Energy in doing basic science and applied engineering research. The focus of NREL, both at our main campus in Golden, Colorado, as well as our Fairbanks campus, is advancing the state of renewable technologies, as well as understanding the engineering challenges of deploying large amounts of renewable energy on the electric power grid. So there's about 3,000 people that work across the labs, and I work with about 100 other analysts and electrical engineers with the primary focus of, again, understanding how do you incorporate renewable energy onto the power grid, given the fact that these technologies are quite a bit different than our kind of traditional gas, oil, and coal resources. So a big part of what I do is study the electric power grid for the U.S. I've worked on or studied just about every power grid in the U.S. Alaska was actually the last piece of the grids that I had not gotten a chance to work on. So it was great to work in the Alaska Rail Belt grid and get a deeper understanding of the potential role of renewables on the rail belt grid. The scope of the study is, and one of the concerns is the cost and supply of electricity on the existing rail belt. So in 2022, the average residential rate for U.S. consumers across the entire U.S., and this is about what I pay personally, was about 14 cents per kilowatt hour. In Alaska Rail Belt, it's about 23 cents per kilowatt hour. This price difference alone for the average residential consumer in the state of Alaska is an additional $590 per year in additional electricity costs compared to what I pay for the same amount of electricity usage. And one big concern, of course, is the potential increase in costs that may occur in coming years. There's concern about the decreasing supply of natural gas in the Cook Inlet and projections by all the utilities. By all the utilities that there will be a substantial increase in costs. One estimate that we use that is basically in line with what the Rail Belt utilities are assuming is that an increase in cost of natural gas resulting in about $12 per million BTU in kind of the 2028-2029 time frame. This alone, on top of the higher than average costs in Alaska, this alone would add about $75 million a year just in 2029 and continue to increase as the cost of natural gas increases. And the reason why this is so important is that natural gas provides about two-thirds of the electricity in the Rail Belt. So great exposure not only to the increased costs, but also the volatility of natural gas prices. We saw spikes of natural gas, LNG global commodity prices after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, with natural gas LNG spiking to over $20 per million BTU. It's not there now, it has come back quite a bit. But again, this is an example of the potential volatility that the use of natural gas has in the Rail Belt system. So one of the issues is, can you offset some of this natural gas usage with renewables, particularly buying long-term contracts for renewables? Because when you develop a renewable energy project, you're typically signing a 20 to 25 year, or sometimes even more, a long-term fixed price contract. You're locking in the cost of electricity for that fraction provided by wind and solar for the coming decades and reducing the overall volatility of the system.
Chair Rauscher.
Representative Shragi has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Rauscher. And through the chair, I was wondering if the presenter could maybe actually just back up a little bit prior to the study. Where did this study come about? Is this just something you guys do routinely? Did the legislature commission it? So can you just, what was the impetus for the study? And then you guys are part of the Department of Energy, is that correct? So this isn't something that was done at the request of a think tank or some other organization. This is a governmental study? Or can you just speak a little bit about kind of who you guys are and what the impetus of the study was? I think that'd be helpful.
Through the chair, thank you. I should have said that. I apologize for that. So the origin of this study actually came about 3.5 years ago from the governor's office, who was at the time interested in an 80% renewable portfolio standard, but had the important and simple question, is there enough renewable resource in the state? And what might the mixes of renewable resources be? So the original study, which was performed by NREL using Department of Energy dollars, because came through Senator's office. There was no Alaska money involved in the original study or this study, the cost analysis. So this is a DOE-supported analysis based on that original request that came through the governor's office. And so we did the original feasibility study that we released 2.5 years ago that basically said, okay, yeah, you've got some wind and solar up here. You've got hydro opportunities up here. But we couldn't do cost analysis. We had a kind of a two-month kind of turnaround on that original study. And so the obvious question then is like, well, can you actually save money by deploying renewable energy? So this round of study, also completely funded by DOE dollars, was to answer that question.
Thank you very much. Very helpful.
Please continue. Thank you.
Thank you. So one of the kind of summary issues or summary points that we're trying to explore here is whether or not you can offset the cost of natural gas purchases in the existing power plant fleet. So moving forward, you're going to need to maintain the existing fossil fuel fleet for purposes of reliability. The question, though, is, well, can I just simply use those power plants less? Can I avoid some of the gas costs? Just like, you know, if you buy a different car, maybe you're going to use less gasoline. So the point here is, can I offset the cost of purchasing natural gas for these power plants with renewables? This chart here shows what we call the avoided cost of the existing power plants in the Rail Belt region. These are actually the four most efficient plants that provide the majority of the natural gas-fired electricity in the Rail Belt. So you've got the Nisqually plant in the Kenai, and then you've got the three plants that are kind of in the central region, either Chugach or MEA. So the George Sullivan South Central is another one, and Iqaluit power plant. These are efficient plants, and they're the most efficient, you know, kind of modern state-of-the-art plants. And essentially, when you generate a kilowatt hour of electricity from one of these plants, the utility has to purchase gas at the cost of right now 7 to 8 cents per kilowatt hour. So I talked about 23 cents per kilowatt hour for the total cost of electricity. 7-8 cents of that comes from just buying the fuel. The other part comes for maintaining the wires going to your house and billing and paying off the power plant itself. But about 7-8 cents of that cost comes from purchasing gas. And that's just a pass-through. The utility is not making a profit off of that. They just have to buy the gas to run the plant and then pass those costs over to the consumer. The expectation is that in the late 2020s, the need to import liquefied natural gas will increase those costs to, in some cases, north of 10 cents per kilowatt hour. So an additional 3 cents per kilowatt hour on top of that, you're already above kind of average price that they're paying, there's going to be another 3 cents per kilowatt hour for these additional natural gas costs. And so the simple question is, can I offset some of those 10 cent per kilowatt hour electricity requirements, gas purchases with renewable energy? So that's a big focus of this study, is understanding the potential costs of new renewables, accounting for the fact that, okay, fine, I can purchase a kilowatt hour of electricity from wind and solar, but what are the implications of the integration of that? The fact that the sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow, there's error in forecasting. I may think the sun's going to shine today, but it might not. What are the cost impacts of dealing with the variability and uncertainty of the solar and wind resources? Because if I can avoid 10 cents per kilowatt hour electricity with 7 cents per kilowatt hour wind and solar, I'm not going to save 3 cents. I'm going to actually save a little bit less than that, because there's going to be these additional costs of integrating the wind and solar resources. And that's kind of my specialty, is understanding the integration of these resources and the cost implications of that. So that's the main question that we're asking in light of the fact that we have improving technology. So what you're seeing here is the actual purchase price, these long-term contracts that have been signed over the past decade plus for wind energy in the lower 48. And you can see that declining trend of where I talked about buying wind for something like 6 or 7 cents per kilowatt hour. You can actually see that in really good wind resources, particularly kind of the Midwest, the yellow, that SPP, that's called the Southwest Power Pool. Those are places like Kansas, Oklahoma, fantastic wind resources. You're never going to get that in the state of Alaska. Wind is more expensive to just build up here. You got to have you have to have the cold weather package, and we just don't get that kind of production up here. So you're never going to see 2 cents per kilowatt hour electricity from wind in Alaska. You're more likely going to see kind of in the moderate regions in the West and some of the places like New England, which are right now in the more like the 4 to 5 cents per kilowatt hour. And you're still not going to get 4 to 5 cents per kilowatt hour from wind in Alaska. It's going to cost more. But what you're seeing here is this trend of declining costs for wind and solar. So one thing that's really important to emphasize is the previous wind projects that have been installed in Alaska, that's decade-old technology. So you can kind of look to the left of the curve and see, yeah, we used to be spending 8 cents per kilowatt hour for electricity from wind previously using those old technologies. The next set of wind plants that you're going to build in Alaska are going to be, again, current state-of-the-art technology. So it will be substantially better, lower cost than what was installed in Alaska in previous decade. Okay, this slide is a little bit busy, but what we're trying to say here is one of the things that we need to understand is what is the difference in cost? So when you're doing something like a rate case, you have to understand all of the costs of the utility, the existing debt, the cost of billing and metering. That's not what we're doing here. We're simply trying to understand what is the difference in costs between what we're doing now, just if we kind of do a business as usual, just burning gas, and adding wind and solar. So if you add wind and solar, that incurs additional costs, a whole bunch of different costs in terms of capital and operations and maintenance, and all these integration costs. But when you make those investments, you're then offsetting other costs such as fossil fuel. So that scale there is supposed to represent those differences. There are critically important costs about existing debt, and if we were talking about rate cases, we would need to consider that. But again, we just want to know what's the difference, how much more or less might we spend when we start adding renewable energy to the grid. The approach that we did in the study is following something called integrated resource planning. That is a standard decades-old utility term that basically says, I need to look at all the different mixes of resources and figure out what is the lowest cost mix of fossil, renewable, other resources that would result in, while maintaining the same or better levels of reliability, what's the cost of all these different resources? This is pretty standard stuff. There's software packages that you can buy. It's very expensive software, but that's what's doing the heavy lifting here to figure out what is the appropriate mix of these resources and how much will it cost. What we did is look again at the rail belt. We're looking at the Golden Valley in the north, the central region, which is MEA and Chugach, and then Homer on the Kenai. One of the big caveat associated with this analysis is we are assuming a transition to greater planning and dispatch coordination. That means the utilities just work together more often to figure out, okay, a good example of this, which is very common, is you may invest in, say, a 50-megawatt wind farm, and you may go in with your neighbor, extremely common. Essentially, you have a framework where, okay, I'm going to buy 68.2% of the plant, and this guy's going to buy 11%, et cetera. Those are the types of things we're talking about here. Those kinds of joint decisions where if somebody builds a wind farm, you know, their neighbor says, hey, I want to go in on you with part of that. And all of those kinds of business arrangements would have to be arranged. We're not assuming consolidated utilities here. We're just saying that the utilities are working together for both the planning and the operation of the grid. We ran a number of scenarios. Again, the baseline scenario was this no new renewable scenario where it establishes, okay, what's the cost of just doing what we're doing right now? And then how much less might it cost if we just do what we think would be the cost optimal or least cost mix of resources? In that case, we're not prescribing renewables. What we're saying is just do whatever you think is the least cost. Build new fossil plants, continue to burn natural gas, or consider new renewables. And so that's the one I'm going to be talking about mostly, because that's the one that I think demonstrates overall the potential opportunities for renewables. Of course, this is all in the context of the RPS, so we did the RPS case. But really what I want to focus on here is more of just, is there an opportunity for renewables to reduce the cost of electricity in general? But again, we did do the 80% by 2040 RPS as well. I'm not going to go through this. This is basically just providing a list of all the generation options we considered. I think one of the big things, perhaps one of the biggest deficiencies in this analysis, is we did not get a chance to look at new large hydro plants. That would potentially decrease the cost of renewable energy options in the state of Alaska, given the potential opportunities here. But we didn't have good cost data, so excluded that. So hopefully this then becomes a more conservative case. We're focusing primarily on wind and solar, but as other new technologies come along, they may have the opportunity to further reduce the costs. Load growth was fairly moderate based on population growth, and the most conservative estimate we could find for potential adoption of electric vehicles. So this isn't really, nothing is really changing associated with load. It's primarily kind of the existing load, but maybe about a 20% increase in load on top of that between now and 2040.
Can I ask a question?
Please.
So when you look up the makeup of the utilities on the rail belt and the makeup of utilities across the United States, lower 48 states, are we comparable as far as we are a state full of co-ops? And so are the other states that we're talking about in lower 48? Or are they non-co-op? Are they a mixture? Are they 100% co-op like we are on the rail belt? How does that work down there in lower 48? And how does that affect some of the numbers that you're projecting here due to some of the data that you've gained from some of those in lower 48?
Thank you, Chairman Rusher. In the lower 48, every single state except for Nebraska, for the most part, is primarily investor-owned utilities. Nebraska is the only state which it's all public power. So there's basically three utility models, either municipal-owned or city-owned utilities, cooperative, which are similar. They're also not-for-profit, but about three-quarters of the electricity system in the U.S. is operated by investor-owned for-profit utilities. So Alaska is quite unique in that the main utilities are these public entities. The impact of that type of utility tends not to really drive too much in terms of which ones are doing renewables. We see a lot of investor-owned utilities, particularly those that are under kind of greater regulatory requirement, have renewables, but we see lots of municipal and cooperative utilities having these kinds of various mixes of renewables.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your answer. Please continue.
So one of the important elements of making renewables work and potentially using them to reduce the cost of electricity in the rail belt is the use and potential expansion of the existing transmission network. There's basically two transmission lines that are of importance in the rail belt. The first being the Alaska Intertie, running essentially from Fairbanks down into the greater Anchorage region, and then the Kenai intertie running from kind of the Anchorage region into Homer Electric. We did not assume that the Alaska intertie would be upgraded. We wanted to really, again, make fairly conservative assumptions about the ability of renewables to be incorporated into the grid. I personally think it would be fantastic if the Alaska intertie were upgraded. I think there would be considerable cost benefits of that. But again, let's not do that. Let's just keep it as it is and just focus on the more likely kind of near-term upgrade, which is the Kenai intertie upgrade. There's some federal dollars available there, and you know, others, I think you're all familiar with that. So we did assume that there was this substantial upgrade in the 2033 type timeframe. And that the benefit of that is there's a lot of benefits to that beyond renewables, just increasing the overall reliability of the system. But it does actually enhance our ability to add more renewables in the Kenai, where some of the better wind resources are, and ship that energy up into the Anchorage area. So that upgrade was assumed. And then, of course, whenever you're adding renewables, you've got to add the additional transmission line to connect those renewables into the grid. Those all had to be considered, and the costs of those also have to be included. So all those interconnection costs, substation upgrades were also included in the cost analysis.
Can I ask really quick?
Representative McKay, do you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, very quickly, I just want to make sure my acronyms are PV and ITC on that. I think I know what they mean, but I want to be sure.
Through the chair, thank you. Slide. Through the chair, thank you, and apologies for the excessive jargon. PV is solar photovoltaics.
And, I guess, right. Okay, I thought that was photovoltaic.
Yeah, and ITC is the investment tax credit. I'll briefly touch on the investment tax credit, I think, in about just one or two slides.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So, okay, it's really important to capture the cost of renewables and not just say, okay, we're going to just build a bunch of wind turbines and not capture all the additional costs that needed to be included. So when you're talking about adding renewables to the grid, the first thing, of course, is you have to build the stuff. And that can either be done through by the utility themselves. And so the utility can take on additional debt and build it themselves. And that is a model that some utilities do. However, historically, especially when utilities are getting started on this, they're going to let somebody else do that. They're going to let somebody else take the risk, somebody else with greater expertise in doing the project financing, actually putting the stuff in the ground. And so historically, a lot of wind and solar is acquired through what's called a power purchase agreement. And the really nice thing about a power purchase agreement is this then becomes the same type of pass-through cost that you typically associate with something like natural gas. The utilities do not need to incur additional debt. They don't need to go to the bank and all the issues around credit risk and all that. This is simply they're signing a contract with a developer that said, for each kilowatt hour I generate, that for each kilowatt hour the power producer generates, they will pay a price for that kilowatt hour. If it doesn't produce, you don't pay. And that is a very common model in the lower 48. It happens all the time. And developers are very comfortable with this type of power purchase agreement. We saw the recent Houston Solar project signed through a power purchase agreement. So, again, I think this would likely be the model that would be used. But, again, we're neutral in terms of how the utilities acquire this energy. So, again, if you're acquiring it through a power purchase agreement, you're just going to give the developer a cost per unit of electricity they generate. They're going to take that money and use it to pay off the loan, et cetera. So those are costs are included. The other costs that need to be considered are the cost of actual interconnection. Again, spur lines, substation upgrades, those are all included. And then a whole host of integration-related costs that I'll get to in more detail. And those are often some of the more, I wouldn't say controversial, but needs to be clarified because, again, some of these costs will be incurred by the utilities. So some of these integration costs will be incurred by the developers, but some of these integration costs will be incurred by the utilities themselves. And the utilities need to make sure that they understand what those costs are and make sure that those costs are accurately reflected in the costs of adding wind and solar. And so these benefits that I'm talking about, these avoided natural gas costs, that's one thing, but are these numbers as big as you'd like them to be given the additional integration costs? Mentioned the investment tax credit. So this is kind of the big thing right now. The Inflation Reduction Act includes provision for either 30, 40, or 50% investment tax credit, depending on a bunch of different factors. Some of the developers think they can get the 50% investment tax credit. Again, I can't guarantee that, so I wanted to use the more conservative 40% investment tax credit number. If you can get the 50% tax credit, great. But that's the investment tax credit is available and does substantially reduce the cost of deploying renewables. There's no doubt that the economics of this are greatly enhanced by the availability of those federal dollars.
Mr. Rauscher?
Representative Schrager has a question.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. How long does the investment tax credit, what's the horizon on that?
Through the chair, right now the actual wording is a little bit confusing, so I rely on experts who've read the IRS guidance and all that, give me insight. And there's something called a safe harbor provision that basically says as long as you've got the project started by a certain date, you're going to get it. So we basically assume that all the projects built in this study would fall under the existing tax credit or kind of get into that safe harbor period. So all of the projects that we build out to the 2040 time frame are eligible for the ITC based on the information I've received.
Follow up, if I may?
Follow up, Rep.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. So just to clarify, through 2040, you have to start you can start the project through 2040 and then have it continue, or when do you have to have the project started?
Yeah, through the chair, I think that it was something around you have to start the project by 2030, late 2030s. I think it's documented there, but I think it would be better for me to actually get you one of the experts to give you the kinds of information that I received so I don't misinterpret the provisions.
Sounds just a follow-up comment maybe. Sounds like there is a limited window of opportunity here for deployment of a lot of these renewable opportunities.
There definitely is a limited window. They do have to be started by a date well before 2040.
Now, if you could get us that information, we could pass it out to the committee members.
Yes.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you. Okay, so I showed you some really good numbers in terms of actual power purchase agreements that are being signed in the lower 48. We're seeing 2 cent, 3 cent per kilowatt hour numbers in the lower 48. And that's a combination of some of those places fairly easy to build, flat terrain in the middle of Iowa, really good wind resources, not going to happen in Alaska. One of the bigger uncertainties is, well, how much is it actually going to cost to build things in Alaska? Using a limited set of data, we made assumptions that it will cost for things like solar that don't require new roads built fairly close to existing transmission. We assume that the cost of installing new solar would be about 50% higher in Alaska compared to the lower 48. For new wind, we assumed it would be 85% higher, or basically 1.85 times more expensive to build things in Alaska, given the challenging terrain, cold weather, all those issues. We do assume that those costs will come down over time. The costs of doing business in Alaska are driven by at least two factors that we consider. One is it's cold here. That's not going to change. But one thing that may change is the limited market size. If I'm a utility in Iowa, in Colorado, I go out to the marketplace. I issue what's called a request for proposal, request for projects. I say, I want to build 200 megawatts of wind. Come at it. I get a half a dozen developers all fighting, cutting costs so they win my business. You don't have that in Alaska. So if there is an emerging market, it has the opportunity to make renewables more competitive in Alaska due to market forces, competition. So we assume that there will be greater competition over time, but there's a floor to that. We assume that it's always going to be 60% more expensive to build wind in Alaska, but it will be less than what it is now due to these market forces. So that's why we see the Alaska cost multiplier going down over time because of the assumption of the unleashing market forces.
Can I ask a question? Is it less valuable up here? And I'm going to qualify that by daylight hours, snow, sitting on top of solar panels, or the amount of darkness that we all have, and there's a difference between Juneau, and there's a difference between Fairbanks. Okay, could be as much as an hour and a half, 2 hours worth of daylight, but there's also a lot of times when it's dark and then you don't have wind. Where in the lower 48, I don't think you have as much of a variation in daylight and dark as we experience up here. So I guess, is there Is there a bigger loss of determining the advantage up here as opposed to somewhere in California?
Thank you, Chairman. Yes, solar energy is less valuable here than it is in a place like California. In a place like California, Arizona, where it's hot and sunny, when it's hot out, huge air conditioning demand, it's also sunny. And solar can actually reduce not only the fuel, but actually the need to construct new generation facilities in a place like Arizona. You don't have that benefit here. So one of the nice things about doing the study is a lot of the reliability calculations that I have to do to calculate the reliability benefits of solar, I didn't have to do here. They're zero. Basically, the only thing wind and solar can do here in the state of Alaska is offset the need for fuel use. It's not really going to offset the need for new generation capacity. You need all the thermal and hydro capacity. It's just a fuel-saving benefit. So you know, all those factors were taken into account. And in fact, the simulations that we do consider the actual solar availability. And yeah, the solar resource is not as good here in Alaska as it is in a place like Arizona and California, which is one of the reasons why we tend to see a more wind-dominated system here in Alaska when we do these estimates. The wind resource is actually surprisingly good. I was pleased to see some of the higher quality wind resources in the state of Alaska. We do build some solar for a variety of reasons, just because solar is just getting cheaper. And it can, again, provide energy to offset those natural gas costs. But yeah, doesn't provide much reliability or any reliability benefits.
So following up on what you said there, looking at our summers, the average summer day in California, the average summer day in Alaska, both of them are sunny. But I believe you have the sun over here, and you have the sun over here on that same day, June 21st, which is the middle of it. Does that have a big bearing on the efficiency of solar as opposed to even when we have an all day, sunny day?
That's actually a great question. I love those types of questions, the technical questions. So, basically what you're doing there is you're actually changing the orientation of the solar panels because, again, the sun is weird here, right? It does this weird...
A lot of them are stationary.
Yeah, so they are stationary, and you don't collect as much energy on the stationary panels here in Alaska as you do in the lower 48 at the lower latitudes. Yeah, but that's a big configuration. How you actually configure the orientation, and there's a bunch of other cool technical things that you have to do special up here to make solar work.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Any more questions? Please continue.
Okay, so this is really kind of just illustrating that cost difference. The dotted lines are the estimated capital costs for wind and solar. And the fact that they're about the same right now is really just coincidence. It just happens to be where we are on kind of the state of the technology. So the axis here is the cost per kilowatt. So that's this kind of standard number that we use to price out power plants is dollars per kilowatt. And really what you're seeing here is the fact that just things are more expensive here. Those solid lines are significantly greater than the dotted lines, but should come down due to both the factors we talked about earlier, the declining, the increasing cost competitiveness due to market forces, as well as general increases in technology. We've just continually seen the pretty dramatic cost reductions in the cost of wind and solar technologies. They're not going to continue like they have been in the past. I mean, when we didn't install wind and solar, you know, we had no economy of scale. But now we've achieved economy of scale, big factories producing these things. So we're still getting kind of incremental improvements in the technology. And so that's why the costs in everywhere will continue to decline over time. So that's the assumed capital costs. I'm not going to go over...
Representative McKay has a question.
Yeah, same as before. What's a GFM inverter? Sorry.
Yeah, to the chair. Sorry for that. I didn't talk about that. So one of the big concerns here in Alaska is grid stability. In general, the smaller the grid, the more difficult it is to keep the grid stable. And when I use the word stable, what I'm talking about here is the ability to maintain the frequency of the electricity, as well as maintain the voltage within certain levels. So your outlet is about 110, 115 volts, and you can't let that go too high or too low, you'll destroy the appliances. So keeping that voltage within a certain tolerance, keeping the frequency. That's all what we talk about when we talk about stability. And so one of the things that's going to be really important here in Alaska is deploying new technologies to make sure that you maintain grid stability. One of those technologies is something called a grid-forming inverter. We don't do that right now. We don't need to. We do something called a grid-following inverter. We let the grid, we let the power plants establish the characteristics of the grid, and then when we add something like solar and wind that uses electronics to inject electricity into the grid, we let those power electronics just look at what the grid is doing and just shove its energy onto the grid. Can't do that in these really high renewable scenarios because you're not using your thermal generators all the time. There are periods where the renewables are doing all the heavy lifting. And so in those cases, we need an entirely new class of these power electronics devices. Fortunately, we know all about these. We've got a lot of experience. The Kauai Electric in Hawaii, which is a little bit larger than Homer Electric, they've been doing this now for about 5 years, where they get, during some times of the day, they get just about all of their electricity from solar, and they've installed these grid-forming inverters. So we've got utilities experience. Highly recommend you all take a trip down there to see what they're doing, maybe in the January-type timeframe, so you can understand and see what the utilities are doing during this transition. So we're assuming that in the kind of the late 2029-type period, you're going to need to start informing these grid-forming inverters to maintain grid stability. That will be critical. You can't just put renewables on the grid and maintain stability without adding some extra pieces and parts to the grid to make them work.
Okay, Mr. Representative.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
So it was the Houston solar project, was that able to be in this study here, or was that just too new for you to make any kind of heads or tails out of that?
I think we did include that. That's a relatively small project. We did include that. That plant does not need anything special. There's not enough renewables on the grid that you need to do anything yet. So
I'm just going to pick up on a word you said here, small project, right? And that was what, 14,000, was it, solar panels?
I don't know the exact number.
I just want everybody to understand what we're talking about when we say small project.
So I apologize for that. Yeah, so this was a multi-megawatt project. So if you actually go visit, it's quite sizable. Again, I'm typically thinking of the types of power plants sizes that I'm used to. So when I think about solar plants that I'm typically working with in lower 48, they're hundreds of megawatts in size. So again, apologize for my scale issues.
How many solar panels is 100 megawatts?
A typical.
Just off the top of your head. I mean, we're looking at 1 million, 2 million, 5 million.
No, there are thousands. They're not in the millions, but these are thousands. I mean, these can occupy, you know, multiple football fields worth of size. That's kind of the way to think about it, is many, many football fields worth of area.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Please continue.
Okay. One of the big things, of course, is where's the wind resource located and where the people live. And like much of the U.S., people tend not to live in super windy areas. The best wind resources that we identified were either in the Kenai or up around Fairbanks. And again, that's an important reason to utilize the existing and potentially new transmissions as much as possible, because of course the major load centers being around Anchorage, we're gonna, for this to work cost effectively, it would be great to get that power down into those areas. We evaluated a large number of sites. We did not have the same data that current developers have, and we're not evaluating the actual sites that are being considered by the utilities, the precise locations. So I think this is more representative of what you might see as opposed to actually where these wind sites will be developed. They're just, the data quality for wind and solar resources in Alaska, quite frankly, is just not as good as what we have in the lower 48. So this is what we evaluated, but again, probably the actual locations are going to be somewhat different.
So what would be the difference between the developer's data and your data?
Thank you, Chair. We are using a large data set that was generated by NASA that has a pretty good perspective on the general trends of the wind resource in the state, but not the specific at that particular location. So what developers do is they're oftentimes, historically, you put up an anemometer, wind speed measuring device, or you're taking local measurements using some some cool lasers that shoot, you know, up in the sky and actually measure movement of particles in the space. So we don't have access to that data. That's proprietary information. It's trade secret kind of stuff. And so we're kind of just taking a more general approach, because again, we can't get on the ground and evaluate every individual site.
Any other questions? Please continue.
So bottom line is, I've kind of talked about here is, okay, what are we looking at in terms of the potential avoided costs? What are we looking at in terms of comparing that 10 cent per kilowatt hour electricity from gas, avoiding that through some of these long-term contracts? And here we're looking at the cost of wind and solar, assuming kind of a typical performance for these technologies. So again, the cost of wind at roughly 6.5 cents per kilowatt hour means that before we start talking about integration, so we're not there yet, but the basic starting point is maybe saving consumers in the state of Alaska 3.5 cents per kilowatt hour for all the generation from wind right now. And that number will, that difference, that savings will increase over time as wind technologies get more competitive in the state. So you're starting off with mostly wind being the more cost competitive option, some solar, but you know, solar maybe coming in, becoming even more cost competitive in the later times. But you know, starting off with, okay, we think that you've got the resource potential to save money. And so now you have to start doing the complicated math of, okay, yeah, maybe 3 cents per kilowatt hour, but what's the actual number after we start integrating? And so that's where we need to start considering the kind of obvious, easy stuff, the hardware such as spur lines and interconnection. But then we get into the really fun stuff of, how do we understand how much natural gas is actually avoided when you start changing the output of all these power plants, when you start turning them on and off? Because every time you turn off a power plant and turn it back on, that imposes a cost. The simplest part of that is a lot of these power plants boil water to make steam. If you turn a power plant off, the water cools down, and we start it back up, you've got to burn a lot of fuel just to reboil that water. So every time you shut a plant off in the middle of the day, it's sunny, you turn the plant off, but then you know, night happens, you have to turn that plant on, you've incurred an additional cost. That's a cost that you would not have incurred had you not had renewables on the grid. So that's an example of these integration costs that absolutely need to be considered when you actually want to know how much gas to actually avoid. There are other capital cost investments required. So there's probably going to be natural gas fuel storage requirements, because instead of burning kind of a constant amount of natural gas throughout the day, you turn the plant off, you're using less gas. You turn that plant on, you've got a big spike in demand. There may be additional natural gas storage requirements. So those were included in the study as well. There's also going to be the fact that instead of controlling a dozen or so power plants throughout the rail belt, now you've added another few other dozen. Every one of those plants needs communications. Every one of those plants needs forecasted to understand whether or not the wind is going to blow that day. You need detailed controls of those plants. Those are costs. And then, as I mentioned, the cost of these grid-forming inverters to maintain stability. So all of these costs need to be considered when you want to know if these things are actually going to save you in the net. I mentioned this earlier. In terms of, are we evaluating the reliability benefits of renewables? Are we, you know, are they going to reduce the amount of natural gas plants actually needed? No, they're not going to provide any reliability benefits. All they're going to do is offset fuel. There's a potential that they could provide some reliability benefits, but to be conservative, and because we just don't have the good data, I think it's reasonable to starting off and saying, no, they're not providing any reliability benefits to the grid whatsoever. All they're doing is offsetting natural gas. The findings of the study are kind of phrased in terms of six key findings, three of which focus on kind of the technical reliability aspects that I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail unless you'd like to know about them. The key findings really focus that I want to talk about are really around the potential cost savings and deployment. So the first finding is that if you do this kind of cost optimum build out, if you build out what we think is the least cost mix of resources, we get to the point where renewables are providing about 75-76% of electricity in 2040. And again, this is because you want to avoid as much of that natural gas generation as possible. Not only the natural gas consumption in the central and Homer region, but also the oil-fired units in Golden Valley, which are really expensive. So you want to build out as much as possible. You want to avoid as much generation from those units as possible. You want to keep them there for reliability, but you just don't want to use them. And I know it always sounds a little bit weird, but we've got an entire electric power system built around power plant assets that are very rarely used. And it makes economic sense to kind of build this mix of resources. And so again, what you want to do, the best thing for the consumers in the state of Alaska is absolutely keep those power plants around, just use them as little as possible and use lower cost generation resources when it's available. So cost savings. Every year you're investing, you're paying for new renewables, and the right hand side graph is showing the difference between the payments and the benefits. The pinkish weird color at the bottom, those are all the costs that you're spending on the renewable purchases. That's the cost of building and maintaining new wind, new solar. And then on top of that, you've got all these other spur line costs and storage and all these. These are hundreds of millions of dollars per year of costs that you have to deploy these renewable energies. By spending these hundreds of millions of dollars per year, you're avoiding even more hundreds of millions of dollars per year. So you're making the investments in the pink and you're avoiding the blue and everything that's above the blue. And that's primarily by building and investing in renewables, you're avoiding the cost of purchasing natural gas. So the net of all that, after taking into account all of the stuff that you have to spend and all the benefits, you're netting out at about $100 million per year, starting around the 2030 type time frame.
Representative McKay has a question.
Thank you. that's some kind of alarm.
That's my cell phone.
This is fascinating, Doctor. Thank you very much. I have a really lot of questions, but one thing that I wonder if you're taking into account is by displacing our natural gas production in state, then we don't get any taxes and royalties from renewables. So there is also a cost to state government because we don't get the taxes and royalties from natural gas extraction in state. Have you taken that into account here? I'd rather doubt it. There is a penalty there for if you say, well, we're just not going to use in-state natural gas to nearly the largest extent that we do now, then there's no taxes and royalties that go to the treasury by the renewables. So I think you need to factor that in, right?
Yeah. Through the chair, thank you for that. So I am not an oil and gas expert, so I want to make that very clear. I'm an electrical engineer. So the details of how the royalty systems work, I don't know. I will state, and the working assumption here is that you're avoiding imported LNG. So this is no longer natural gas that's produced in state. This is avoiding natural gas that is going to be imported from other locations. So whether or not there's tax implications of that, that definitely I cannot answer. But I'm thinking that since we're not avoiding in-state gas generation, maybe that mitigates some of those concerns. But again, I should stop there.
No, I'll just follow up. Mr. Chairman, so it's petroleum engineer against electrical engineer, and I think we could enjoy our discussion. But so your whole study is based on very little in-state gas production and almost everything imported LNG. That's kind of the foundation of this.
Through the chair, yes. Essentially, what we're looking at is the marginal resource, right? I mean, obviously, there's going to continue to be in-state natural gas production. I think the working assumption is, given the fact that roughly I think two-thirds of the natural gas goes towards heating applications, you're really avoiding the whatever on the margin, right? And so so the marginal resource is likely to be this LNG. So again, maybe that's the answer.
Okay, thanks. Thanks.
Representative, by the time HB 223 gets passed and your royalty tax package gets passed, there won't be much of that either. So, Representative Shragi, you have a question.
No, actually, Chair Rauscher, to the chair, I was actually going to make the same point that I don't know how much of a royalty there's going to be in the future, given the current proposals under consideration. So, complicated issue.
And I did mention one of my bills too. So I just wanted to, I was being fair. I was just having fun at your
expense. Yeah, I know you were.
Sorry.
I had to make this.
So I do have a question, though. Once you add battery in there, I mean, solar, wind is now. Okay, you get it now. Once you add battery and you add storage, that jacks the actual cost way up, and the cost reduction way down. So what percentage is that calculated into these numbers?
Thank you, Chairman Rocher. There is a cost component to the storage. We actually didn't build as much storage as I originally thought we would. Again, a lot of the benefits of storage is using renewables as this kind of reliability element. So you're storing energy from the wind and sun when it's not available, and storing it and using it when you really need that kind of peak demand. Since we're maintaining the existing thermal fleet, the value of energy storage is reduced somewhat. I mean, there are definitely costs associated with storage that we're absolutely including here, but a lot of the time, the wind and solar is just, it's kind of, there's a term must-take resource that we throw around sometimes. It's basically when the sun is shining, we back off the natural gas generators, and then when the sun's not shining, we crank them back up. But yes, there is definitely some storage built in here. Some of the storage actually doesn't show up in these numbers because some of that is being paid for through the that reliability infrastructure project, the federal dollars there. But there are definitely extra tens of millions of dollars of additional battery storage that's being deployed here.
Okay, thank you. Any more questions? Please
thank
continue
you.
Your presentation.
So cumulatively, we are looking at somewhere north of $1 billion of potential savings here. So essentially, again, it's really important to emphasize that there are substantial investments required here. We're spending about $2.9 billion. The ratepayers of Alaska are spending $2.9 billion, but the ratepayers of Alaska are avoiding $4.2 billion. So you got to spend money to save money. But again, through power purchase agreements and other things like that, there should not be there should never be kind of a spike in prices, right? If you do this through finance power purchase agreements, you're just always going to pay less during this pathway. And so again, $2.9 billion, that's the cost of wind, solar, transmission, battery storage, all these integration costs to avoid 4.2, and primarily, again, those imported LNG costs. So that's where we come up with those cost numbers. In terms of the mix of resources, we're looking at about 50% annual electricity from wind in 2040. So again, the wind resource in Alaska, pretty good. Solar, not as good, but still there. So it's a big chunk of this is from wind, solar, and then again, the existing fossil plants being utilized, producing about a quarter of the rail belt electricity, the existing hydro power plants, phenomenal resources, again, a mix of generation resources, but a lot of this is wind.
So I used to have a windmill on my shop, okay, it was wind generation. But what I found out was that my house, either the wind wasn't blowing enough, or it was blowing too much and it wasn't producing anything because it was shut off. Mm-hmm. Okay, so can you explain for the committee elevation, height of a wind project, how much that changes what I was experiencing over the top of my shop, only being maybe 20, 50 feet high,
yeah,
versus 600 or whatever.
Yeah, thank you, Chairman Rusher. I have to do this in meters because that's the industry standard. So we talk about hub height. So you've got the tower, the steel tower, this is steel, concrete, fiberglass. There's nothing really exotic in any of these things. So you've got the steel tower. When we started doing this in 2001, we started building kind of utility scale wind, the typical hub height was about 80 meters. The average of that has gone up over time, right around to around 100 meters. We are deploying 120 meter hub heights, and offshore we're doing like 140 and all that, but transportation issues. So in general, we're talking about a roughly 100 meter hub height for these wind turbines. And we started off with 1 megawatt machines. Now routinely we're doing 3+ megawatt machines. So the economy scale benefits. So 100 meter hub heights with 76 meter rotor diameter is the typical size. So these are big machines. They produce a lot of energy. When you look at a typical wind turbine, if you go visit a modern wind farm, which you really don't have in Alaska, but if you're visiting seeing it down in Iowa or something like that, see a modern wind turbine, you can kind of see the blades going around. Count to 10, rotations, that will power your house for a day. So one, so just not in very many seconds of that will. I mean, these are slow, right? These are big machines, so it's kind of looks kind of like that. Sorry, I can't put that on the record, but anyway. So yeah, these are you know, kind of not your father's wind turbine technology that we're talking about here.
So Representative McKay has a question.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Doctor, thank you very much. This is a fascinating presentation. I've worked in the oil industry since 1980, worked on the slope, and you know, Alaska's a really hostile place to work, construct things, work outside, much more so than people in the lower 48, I think, really appreciate. You have to have a really big crane to install these. They're very large. And so you have to have a substantial road across potential swamp, permafrost, rivers. I don't know. I mean, it's not like Iowa cornfield. So I just want to be realistic with my colleagues and, you know, understand how we would get the equipment just out there. And installed. I mean, you have a boom of a crane that's, you're talking, what you, you know, 250 feet. that's a really tall operation. It just seems a little bit staggering to be able to go out and do that, just, you know, lickety split. I don't even know if we have a crane that big in Alaska to do something like that. And then, of course, in the wintertime, you know, we looked at Grand Prairie, Alberta. The North Slope, for example, in the wintertime is 20 degrees colder than Grand Prairie on average. So the oil field workers in Grand Prairie were staggered by working on the North Slope in the wintertime. I mean, they just could not fathom the challenge of operating on the North Slope. The other thing I worry about, quite bluntly, is vandalism. We have a lot of people with guns in Alaska. I've already heard stories about target practice on solar panels. So what happens when, you know, you've got a big array of solar panels and some young people go out and they shoot every one of them with a whole, you know, shoot every single panel. What happens? You got to replace every one of them, I'm assuming. That's got to be tremendously expensive, I would think. And then they can also shoot a hole in the wind turbine engine compartment, right? So these are some of the things I worry about, more of a practical matter, about operating this equipment up here. And I guess I'll leave it at that. I've got to go to another committee. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I really appreciate it. Maybe we can have a conversation sometime. I'd really love to dive into this more. Thank you very much.
Through the chair.
They shot the pipeline.
Representative Shragi, and thank you. I appreciate it. You have a committee to go to, right?
Yeah, I'm going to go upstairs for a few minutes. Hopefully I'll get back.
All right. Yep. Representative Shragi.
Thank you, Chair Rauscher, and through the chair. Glad we didn't not develop the pipeline due to concerns over shootings. I think it's developed or provided a lot of benefit to the state of Alaska. So glad we went forward with that. But just on the concerns around wind farms, because I hear my colleagues' concerns, I just wanted to draw members' attention to a February 25th article by ADN. I don't know if folks remember, but a few years ago, we approved funding for a renewable energy fund study, feasibility study for a wind farm below Mount Susitna. It's not identified in the high wind areas here, but they have some very compelling data, and I think we're coming very close to a major investment decision. And just glancing through the article, I think it's just fascinating to see that they bring up a lot of these same concerns. They encounter, include all of those costs in their projections and still appear to have a very viable project. And I would just note that they said that, if I may just read from this article, just very briefly, talking about this proposed project, Chugach Electric said they could have provided about 20% of the electricity used by the city during the recent extreme cold snap, and that the project would have been exceptionally productive during that time period. So just fascinating to think about some of the benefits that could come with these projects. I know there's a lot of concerns around the costs and the roads and building a crane, but despite all those barriers, we have independent power producers currently pursuing these projects and believe it's very feasible despite the difficulty. So anyways, just interesting to think about, and I'll be sure to get a copy of that article to members for consideration because I found it very interesting.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much, Representative Shaw. Any other questions from the two members left here? Please continue with your...
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think we kind of mentioned the fact that we want to build the study finds wind opportunities throughout the Rail Belt, including places like Little Mount Susitna. Again, we did not actually evaluate that particular location because we didn't have good data, but it does generally follow in terms of kind of the production numbers, the performance numbers that we're seeing. What's called capacity factor in terms of their performance are similar to the data we use. So again, I wouldn't say that the specific locations that we identify would be the correct or right ones to build, but again, they're representative of the general locations where we would expect to see wind and solar being built. I've been talking about the reference case, and when we need to talk about the 80%, the specific issue around the 80% RPS, we generally find that, you know, given the uncertainty of costs, obviously everything I'm telling you is wrong, right? In terms of we don't know exactly what the cost savings would be. I'm saying $100 million, but I can't tell you what the exact cost of renewable energy is going to be in 2030. I can't tell you what the cost of natural gas is going to be. So kind of within the noise, 76%, 80%, that's all kind of around the same similar type of number in terms of kind of least cost benefits. And it's important to say that when you get to at some point, renewables are not, you know, cost effective. I mean, you start trying to build renewables in less productive resources. You start getting periods where there's not enough solar and wind resources during certain times of the season. It does not become cost effective to talk about potentially going to 90 or 95%. So we're not really talking about that. We understand the fact that there's kind of the right amount of renewables to build in the grid. And what we're saying is that it looks like, you know, in this kind of 75, 80% range, that looks like, from, again, the state of the technologies right now, that would be the right amount. We're certainly not proposing or suggesting to go higher than that. But again, the uncertainty in costs are going to really dominate the correct number that you might get to. But again, the point is, we do see a large potential for cost-effective renewables in displacing natural gas.
Can I ask a question? So technology changes so fast. It's incredible. So the studies that we do today are based on numbers that happened a couple years ago. So are we able to keep up with the new technology to be able to answer the data that we got many years ago efficiently, to be able to say we did it correctly, knowing that maybe we might have missed something in that 3 or 5 year time span, if you understand what I'm trying to say?
Yes, thank you, Chairman. There's lots of different angles on that question. I mean, one of them is the perpetual question is, you know, are you doing something too soon? And so we certainly get, you know, you don't want to deploy technologies when next year's technology is going to be even better. You do want to avoid that. And one of the nice things about, quite frankly, Alaska waiting on renewables is the fact that you avoided some of those really high cost projects. That, you know, California and Germany, they kind of went too soon. And so they didn't get the benefits of these low cost technologies. So in terms of it, we're kind of down at the point where sometimes we talk about these kind of no regrets policies, because once you've reached the point where renewables are kind of below this avoided cost, you know, an investment today will save money. And so if you delay that investment, you delay the opportunity to avoid that benefit. So what we're seeing is that deployment in the kind of the near term can be cost effective, and you don't have kind of compatibility issues. It's like, you know, you buy the latest computer, now your old software doesn't work. There's really nothing like that with the existing technologies. So if you put in a modern wind turbine now, or a modern solar system now, there's not going to be kind of any kind of software issues that can't be easily resolved. So I think we have reasonable confidence that the benefits we're seeing are real, and you kind of aren't going to have too many problems in terms of regrets of installing a certain technology.
So I will ask one more question, because I don't understand wind versus solar. How many solar panels does it take to accomplish what a wind turbine can accomplish nowadays? If we're looking at footprint, if we're looking at cost, if we're looking at technology, if we're looking at... So in other words, we're going to have to build a million wind solar panels to do what one wind turbine can do if you average it out over the year. Or is it a lot less? Or how does this? Is it possible that you've done this at all? Just so we get a perspective on what we're talking about as far as these projects.
Typical solar panel. Sorry, can't put this. Okay, so a typical solar panel has an area of 2 square meters. 10,000 of those, 10,000 individual solar panels to replace one wind turbine it'd be roughly double that. So about 20,000, for the same amount of energy from a wind turbine, you're looking about 20,000 individual solar panels.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Wright has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, just following up on the question the chair asked prior to that. I know every year the iPhone technology changes. You get something new, something flashier. How often does the technology change for the renewable?
Through the chair. So the technology is incrementally improving. So if you were to buy a wind turbine next year, 2 years from now compared to today, it really would look the same. It would be small changes in, at this point, there's a lot of software changes and that can all be updated. If you actually look at a wind turbine that was installed in the early 2000s, they actually basically look the same. They're now just bigger. So the biggest difference would be you might see a slightly larger model in 2 years, but they're not going to look that much different. Same thing for solar. They're going to look the same. It's just process efficiencies and things like that. So we don't have the same, we typically don't have the same type of generational changes with wind and solar now, just because we're at that really mature phase of the marketplace where we pretty much know what we're doing. It's just getting better economy of scale, incremental improvements. Now that's like for storage, that's not the case. For storage, we are seeing kind of generational changes from technology to technology. But for wind and solar, we're there in terms of where we're at.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just a quick note that I believe there's a protest going on outside, and that's what you're hearing in the background here. So. Please continue.
So that's the findings associated with the cost. The rest of the findings are of a more technical nature, oriented towards just really kind of understanding the reliability aspects and emphasizing the importance of maintaining the existing fossil fuel fleet in terms of providing reliability. So we heavily depend on that fleet. And I'm very happy to show you very many periods in which the sun is not shining and the wind is not blowing. That's really what I focus on, because quite frankly, times where it's super windy and some that's the easy part. The hard part is what do you do with the wind and sun is not producing output. So that's what I focus my time on looking at. And we have lots of days where it's not particularly when you're sunny. We maintain reliability. We're just using the plants less. It's not that we're not using them at all. We're just using them less. The graph that I'm showing now is what I'm calling my scary graph, because this is to really emphasize that this represents a fundamental change in how the power system is operated. And this isn't easy. This isn't just put a bunch of wind and solar in the system and expect it to work. This requires new software. This requires new kind of thinking about how you operate the power system. But fortunately, we have 2 decades of experience both in the U.S. and around the world now. I mentioned Kauai Electric, but there are many, many examples where something like this, which really would have been unheard of 20 years ago, is now standard operating procedures. Again, this is not easy. but it's doable. We've got evidence of that. And the point of all this is doing something difficult to ultimately save money. The final element of this is, again, a reminder that it is critically important to analyze these integration costs and to look at how you're going to invest in different mixes of resources to make sure that you can maintain reliability. So in this particular case, we're talking about tens of millions of dollars per year of investments associated with integrating these renewables. So when I talk about the $100 million of savings, I'm netting that out. You know, I'm not saying, $100 million before these additional costs. It's $100 million per year after you've added these tens of millions of dollars in integration cost investments. So again, you're spending hundreds of millions of dollars per year for the renewables, and then many tens of millions of dollars per year in addition to integrate these renewables. And that combination of both the raw resource as well and all the other stuff that that you package around it, that's where you get the $100 million per year in savings. So that is what I have to talk about today. Again, I want to emphasize the fact that we do think that new renewable electricity generations can offset these high natural gas prices, and there's an opportunity not only to reduce bills but also stabilize bills through long-term power purchase agreements, but also acknowledge the fact that there are things that have to be done. This is the beginning. This isn't the end. There are a lot of things that need to be done to validate these findings and make sure that the grid can remain reliable and stable. And with that, happy to take any additional questions.
I just want to remark that there are other committee meetings going on, and people are all trying to make sure they attend them at their proper intervals. So it's not that they don't want to be here. This is on television. They can visit this anytime at home or in their office later. So please don't feel like that. There's a disinterest. There's just a lot of interest around the building today. But do you have any other questions, Representative Wright? I just find the information that you brought very valuable. And I do want you to at least for the committee, tell us the difference between a CES and an RPS, because one's renewables and one's clean. And so if you could give us that as a committee, I think that would be helpful.
Thank you, Chairman. So renewable portfolio standards means a targeted mix of renewable energy resources, where renewables has a large number of defining properties. I mean, you look at renewable portfolio standards around the country, and the definition of renewables varies a lot. One of the biggest things is some places they don't consider large new hydro renewable. That's politics and various things. A clean energy standard, as opposed to a renewable energy standard, is a larger, more kind of inclusive definition that would typically include factors such as nuclear power, as well as certain fossil fuel technologies typically associated with fossil plus carbon capture and sequestration. So clean energy standards is generally more inclusive of those technologies, and again, would be happy to consider those alternatives. There may be some possibilities for those technologies providing lower cost options for Alaska as well. So that's the main difference.
In your experience with NREL and what you've worked on, what's the advantage of one over the other?
Thank you, Chairman. So the primary advantage to kind of more inclusive portfolio standards is the potential to reduce costs. I mean, anytime you place restrictions on what technologies can be deployed, you have the potential of missing new technologies. To date, we haven't seen the success that we want to see in terms of things like small modular reactors. We keep hoping they're going to hit. Maybe they'll hit, but certainly that's one of the big hopes in some of the demonstration projects that are going to happen with nuclear. Right now, given the kind of conservative assumptions we've made, it's like, okay, well, we know that wind and solar are there. But if nuclear happens as well, that again, the more options, the better. So we're certainly neutral in terms of what policy. We don't make policy at NREL. We analyze policies and happy to analyze all technologies. And we have done some analyses where we do see nuclear growth, for instance. So we're neutral as to what we do, but happy to.
Thank you. Representative Wright has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, just since we are on the topic of micro reactors, What does your analysis say when it comes to opposed to the other options? Wouldn't you say micro reactors are probably more viable here in Alaska with all the benefits?
Through the chair, it totally comes down to cost. If the cost of small modular reactors comes down to the point where they're cost effective, great. They have all kinds of advantages. I don't have any deep insights into the likelihood of them being able to achieve those costs. So that's the biggest problem is I have a deep understanding of where wind and solar have gone over the past 20 years. We have a lot of projections and analyses of where those technologies might be going. I have to rely on outside sources for information about nuclear. And unfortunately, I don't have a great number of resources that really give me deep insights into what the potential cost opportunities are. But again, if you know they can get to a point where you know they're cost competitive, that will be a really valuable option. It really just does come down to what they might cost.
Follow up,
Representative.
Would this be a scenario like we spoke of earlier, getting in too early, waiting for the price of it to go down?
Through the chair, I mean, that may be that is one possibility. One of the things, of course, is that I think most of the small modular reactor programs right now that are going on would be through substantial subsidies and demonstration projects, a lot of federal funding. So I think that the most likely thing that happened will get a couple of these things built through these subsidized projects that should hopefully give us some idea of what they might cost. I mean, nobody wants to build the first of anything. So hopefully some of these things will get built and we'll get a better idea of what they might cost.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So let me ask, I'm going to follow up on a question that was asked way earlier, which was the cost of the study, where it came from. And basically, do you do this for every one of the 50 states? And if you do, how do you fund your organization? And how is that benefiting each one of the states? To what degree? And have you seen in their performance after you leave?
Thank you, Chairman. So the way that NREL works is we're primarily responding to the U.S. Department of Energy's goal to understand state of technologies and impact of certain technologies. So the vast majority of studies that we do are actually national in scope. So typically when I'll do a large grid study, it will be from something like an example might be the Solar Energy Technologies Office would say, what happens if we get a 10% reduction in the cost of solar? How might that benefit the nation as a whole? So the vast majority of my studies and those of my colleagues, we will study the entire U.S. power system collectively. So we won't be just studying an individual region. It's all the regions put together and kind of add up all the results. So those are the most common studies that we do. These typically are less about individual states or individual regions, because again, being a federal lab, we're looking at like how can these technologies benefit the nation as a whole. We do, however, do individual regional studies in response to either specific requests from the Department of Energy or working with individual utilities or regions. So one example would be I was the engineering lead for a city study by the city of Los Angeles, who wanted to look at the feasibility of getting to 100% renewable energy. So Los Angeles Department of Water Power contracted with NREL directly to pay for our work in studying their power grid. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So does... So I'm trying to, are you an LLC, a nonprofit? Are you a...
we're what's called an FFRDC, Federally Funded Research and Development Corporation. We're a not-for-profit entity whose majority of funding comes from the federal government. But I'm not a federal employee. We're run by a private not-for-profit company that manages the lab, and we're we can work for other entities, but the bulk of our funding comes from the Department of Energy.
And do they have any pre notions on what they want you to come up with, or is it fair game? Anything you come up with is what we want to know.
Yeah. So we have a specific scientific integrity policy and process in place. We are an independent organization. I mean, we know we know where our money comes from, and you know, we want to be responsible to our client and meet their needs. But we have a higher standard of scientific integrity that, you know, we have to go where the numbers tell us. And so I'm very proud of my role at NREL and in terms of maintaining that level of scientific integrity. And the goal is to provide, you know, technology neutral, you know, policy neutral analyst to the best of our ability using the numbers that we have. One element that's really important to that is an element of transparency. We really try and make all of the data sets that we use publicly available. The tools that we use for the most part are publicly available or open access. So a lot of the modeling software that we develop, the public has access to the code, to the data sets. So we really try and be transparent as much as possible so that our conclusions can be reproduced by independent analysts and agencies.
And I meant no disrespect when I asked the question. I just know there's a lot of people out there who have questions on, you know, who actually is testifying and how they got where they got and how they get the information they got and where, who they're beholden to when they do that. And so I was just giving you the opportunity to be able to speak to that. Representative Shoggy, did you have a question?
Well, yeah, thank you, Chair Rauscher. Just to follow up on that, always appreciate making sure that the studies we're receiving are nonpartisan and accountable, transparent, all those internal policies notwithstanding. I'm very pleased that our Republican governor of Alaska, Mike Dunleavy, felt your group appropriate to do this study. And in this instance, I think I trust the governor.
Through the chair, thank you.
So if there are no other business before us, I really want to appreciate the time you put into the slide deck, the time you put into Alaska, all the data that you've gleaned and you've assembled and you put for us. We appreciate the outcomes that you've projected. Like I say, we take all information into account and yours as well. So we do really want to thank you for coming down this way. It's a long way to come to Juneau, but we appreciate the fact that you did. I know the NREL study has come up on the floor of the House. I know it's been pointed to and by a number of discussions, so I appreciate the fact that you came here to represent it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So with that, I'd like to thank everybody here today. Next, I plan to hear HB 349. Makes it out of its current committee due to the potentially busy forest schedule. We will meet as time allows and continue our business. Having no further business today, I would like to adjourn this meeting at 11:37.